Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll start off with politics with the Globe's Farrah Stockman and WGBH's Peter Kadzis. From casino chaos to an Obamacare sacrificial lamb to lingering questions about a marathon bombing. On other days, John Hockenberry is on before us and after us. Today he's on with us as he's brought the takeaway to Boston for the one-year anniversary of the marathon bombings.
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. We'll ask about a public shaming. And did Jesus have a wife? Then we'll ask you about a new workers' move in France. No more answering emails and phone calls 24/7 from the office. Then the new mayor of Lawrence, Dan Rivera, joins us in studio. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
You don't have a fan with you, do you? Like Andrea Cabral used. Remember that when she was using it at some press
thing? She was having a hot flash.
Oh, my goodness. In any case, will there ever be a casino in eastern Massachusetts? Is the firefighter deal in Boston a good deal? And now that Kathleen Sebelius has resigned as Secretary of Health and Human Services, will this stop the bleeding, or is this a mere Band-Aid fix for the Affordable Care Act? Here with us in Studio 3 to take on these and other political headlines are Boston Globe columnist Farrah Stockman. Hi, Farrah.
Hi.
Nice to see you. And GBH's senior web editor, that would be Peter Kadzis. Hello, Peter.
Hey. Great to be here.
Hi, you guys. Thank you for coming in on this really springy day outside. We're all so excited, except for Jim is complaining about the heat.
Yeah, I had to walk all the way downstairs.
This wasn't easy. Anyway, every time we open up the paper or turn on the news in the last few days, we've read another story about possible exposed communication gaps among the law enforcement agencies looking into the Boston Marathon bombing, whether it's the CIA, the FBI, Boston's Joint Terrorism Task Force. So I want to ask you guys, do we have enough answers about whether this bombing could have been prevented, what went on afterwards? And if we don't, are we ever going to get the answers? We'll start with you, Mr. Kadzis.
We have all the answers we're ever going to get. I mean, this bombing was a fluke. It was too self-motivated, you know, psycho bombers. But the real thing at work here is Americans have, we've surrendered a lot of our civil liberties. We've also surrendered a huge amount of convenience. We have to show IDs everywhere and stuff. So when something like this happens, when it shows that, you know, we cannot be protected 100%, we have to twist ourselves in knots. I mean, the FBI is largely a hype machine, which manufactures its own aura around itself. And I just don't think we're going to find out anything new.
Okay, so let me twist myself in knots, Farrah Stockman, to talk to you. We have been trying to get a straight answer from everybody, from the governor on down, about just one example. 18 months after a triple murder in Waltham, it was not solved. Friends of one of the three victims, Brendan Mess, had told investigators that one of his closest friends was Tamerlan Tsarnaev, who they never interviewed. All we've asked people is, why? What does that suggest? And maybe that is twisting oneself in knots, but it's just emblematic to me of the lack of, what should I call, intellectual curiosity on the part of a lot of public officials about what happened prior to April 15th.
I agree. There is definitely a screw up here. I mean, I'm the last person to say that, you know, oh, we should have prevented every bombing. You can't prevent every bombing.
I'm not suggesting we could either.
But like, there were definitely some screw ups here. For instance, you know, Russia tells us, hey, this guy could be traveling to Russia and get some insurgent training, so you should check him out. The FBI drives out, they check him out, and they close the case, but they say, if he goes to Russia, let us know, right? So sure enough, he goes to Russia, and sure enough, the Department of Homeland Security calls the Joint Terrorism Task Force, tells the customs guy, hey, he's gone to Russia, it's happening. And what does that guy do? We don't know. Apparently nothing. He never walks. I mean, we have no evidence that he walked over across the room to the guy, the case officer, the FBI case officer, and says, hey, that dude is in Russia. I mean, and we know now that those communications are usually verbal or by sticky note. I love that.
It's like a post-it note.
So the marathon bombing happens, and then you say, well, didn't you get my sticky note? Maybe it fell off your computer. It's like...
So why is it, and maybe I'm missing somebody, with the exception of Bill Keating, Peter Katz, this congressperson, former DA, former state senator, who's been relentless in his criticism of the FBI for refusing to show up before the Homeland Security Committee, even in closed-door session. Why are so few politicians willing to push this? By the way, it's in no way, no one's suggesting malevolence. People, I think, are asking legitimate questions about, were there things that we could do better in the future, so there's not another April 15th. We're not saying there was any bad actor or something in terms of law enforcement. Why aren't people willing to ask?
Well, I think on the local level, a cult of the first responder has, you know, grown up in Boston. That's somewhat understandable. I remember that picture the day after the bombing where while everyone else is running away from the bombs, you have those Boston police officers trying to draw their guns running towards
it. It's unbelievable, yeah.
But it's almost as if public officials have put their common sense on hold. Public officials don't want to rock the boat when it comes to challenging a widely held opinion. The other thing is, in the Watertown case, no one will convince me that the public officials don't want to run afoul of the state policeman's union. It's just inconvenient to push too far. The FBI has run rampant for years, and I find it very interesting that, and I give Keating great credit, because one would think that a prosecutor, if anyone was going to be in the bag with the FBI, it would be a prosecutor. And Keating has shown the courage to stand up and ask tough questions.
Well, you know, you almost feel as though, unless this were on the front page of the Globe or the Herald every day, and that we're leading the news here or something, that we're never going to get the answers about what happened in Watertown. Because, you know, I think you saw... In the Jared Remy case, until the district attorney Ryan in the Middlesex County district attorney was absolutely forced to confront the fact that everything didn't go right in arresting him and holding him as he should have been, she didn't really want to go there and revisit it. And in Watertown, I think you're in the same situation, where the state cops don't want to answer questions, the DA doesn't want to answer questions, the local cops don't want to answer questions, because it's pretty clear they did kind of blow it, right?
I think that's right. And I also think you can't underestimate the fact that some of this stuff is classified. Like the report that came out was 200 pages long. Only 30 pages were declassified. So there's a lot of information that we may not, you know, the stuff between Russia and, you know, there's a lot of information that it still might come out. So I think the Globe might FOIA it. Maybe we'll learn something more. But some of this stuff is, it's not going to be discussed in the public.
And by the way, just save you who are listening time so you don't have to send us an email. No one in this room is questioning the commitment or courage of the men and women on April 15th or thereafter until the capture of the younger Tsarnaev in Watertown. These are just, it seems to me, legitimate questions that the public is entitled to know. You know, Peter, a minute ago, you mentioned first responders, firefighters. We learned over the weekend, obviously, the cop contract was a centerpiece in the debate, literal and figurative, between John Connolly and Marty Walsh. The 26.4 or 24.6, whatever the arbitration award was. Well, with no arbitration, the firefighters and the Walsh administration cut a deal. We don't know what the deal is. What's your sense of this thing?
My sense is that the firefighters are going to get something almost identical to what the police got. And my prediction is that the Walsh administration will say, look, this is great. Even though it may look expensive, we avoid arbitration. I mean, avoiding arbitration isn't really the issue. The issue is how much do taxpayers have to pay? Frankly, the Boston City Council, when they voted unanimously, and I happen to be in the
chamber. John
Connolly not being there, because he would have been the only one to vote no, thereby scorching any chance of a political future if he had one. You're right about Connolly. They voted still unanimously, 12 to nothing. I still think of the old days. 12 to nothing with barely a tough question to approve the police contract. So I would imagine it's going to be very similar. And given the death of the two, the lieutenant and the firefighter, I think it would take someone with some real integrity and guts to do anything otherwise.
What do you think, Farah?
Real integrity and guts. We definitely didn't see that on the police contract. I mean, this is a real test of the Walsh administration. Everybody knows how much the firefighters gave him during his campaign. Everybody knows how much they went out there and worked for him. And he would always say, well, look, I can talk sense to them. I'm their union brother. I will be able to sit down with them and strike a deal that's good for the city but also good for them. We won't have to go to arbitration. I can deal with this. So the devil's in the details. Yeah, you avoided arbitration, but how much money is this going to cost us? And I did a lot of work on the police contract. And
you did a great, terrific story in the police contract. It was great.
No one has ever been able to answer the question of why the only point of reference for police salaries is firefighters, and why the only point of reference for firefighter salaries is police. And then they just have this crazy routine where they keep escalating the salaries.
By the way, they said they'd answer that question as soon as they answer the question about why they didn't interview Tamerlan Tsarnaev
exactly.
after Waltham.
Exactly.
So.
But you know, you guys have both know about this and have written about it. The losers here are the kids in the Boston public schools where the budget is getting slashed to pieces. And Walsh already talked about the fact that the police contract was going to cost the city a caboodle of money. So
it's not just
the Boston public schools, Peter?
It's not just the schools. It's the parks. It's the libraries. There are layoffs that are going to, as a result of the policeman's contract. The fireman's contract is similar.
But how do you say it? The problem, it seems to me, and I agree with what both you're saying, what Farah, you said, this is a test, particularly since part of Marty Walsh's response to all the criticism of being a captive of labor. Well, I may be a captive, but I can talk to them. I speak their language. Two firefighters did just die. The cops did get 6.5% a year. So what do you say to the firefighters in the wake of this? You say, I'm going to give you three because of the financial health of the city, Farah Stockman?
If firefighters are underpaid, why is there a line out the door to become one? It is there is no shortage of people who are really, really, really trying hard to be a firefighter. I see no evidence that they're underpaid. I'm not saying they shouldn't get a wage, a good wage. I'm not saying they shouldn't get some raise, but their raises are just astronomically higher than anybody. What about social workers?
Exactly.
Social workers are...
How about bank tellers?
Yeah.
I mean, the thing
guts
is...
Guts and integrity. We
wait
got it right here with
he
you
just
and
say
our
bank tellers?
Social
I said
workers
bank
are public tellers. Safety officials,
yes,
too.
Yes, they are. But and their average pay is $40,000.
Thank you.
You're going to make the case for bank tellers now?
Yes,
or
what are you doing? There are more bank tellers, I would imagine, living in Boston paying taxes than there are cops or firefighters. What it is here is that the public really doesn't care that much. This is going to work out just fine for Marty Walsh because this is early in his administration. Whatever the firefighters get can be blamed on the police contract, which Walsh has no fingerprints on whatsoever. And when he runs for re-election, assuming he does in 4 years, it'll all be forgotten. It is, there are going to be cuts in city services as a result of
I think this is a gender issue. I think it's interesting that the two women in the studio are rooting for the teachers and the social workers, and the two men in the studio are saying, you know, this is the way
no,
it goes.
No, I would interpret
no,
it differently.
I'm not saying that.
Here's what I'm saying.
Not
the
at
argument
all.
When people like Farah and you and others argue, well, how about the social workers? The implication is that people like me don't care. My view is not only should the firefighters get it, so should the social workers. It's not like the lowest common
right.
denominator. The reality is it's expensive to live in and around Boston. These are really hard jobs. Social workers are grossly underpaid. Somebody on Beacon Hill has got a man and woman up and decide they got to figure out how to pay these people real wages.
Look, we have cops today who are making more money than the vice president of the United States. There are a fair amount of cops that make more money.
Well, they're doing more work than
the
vice president of the United States.
They probably are. That's true.
She's killing you, Jim.
I think
she's killing you.
I'm just saying there's not unlimited money.
What?
And John Connolly didn't lose by that much. I got a lot of emails from people who are very concerned about the way that our democracy works now, where if in the city of Boston, if you got firefighters and you got police, they can just elect their boss. They can just elect the person who's going to write the contract for them. And ordinary people are not organized enough to fight that. And so we have to get organized if you're going to have some different priorities.
Okay, so let's move
that
on
was
to
brilliant.
Another Marty Walsh issue. Marty Walsh is seeking host community status as relates to both of the final contestants for the Eastern Mass Casino. That would be Everett. And that would be Revere. A couple of interesting things have happened since the last time we discussed this, including with him, actually, I guess two Fridays ago. One, Speaker DeLeo, with whom, who's from, obviously, Revere, and he lives in Winthrop, represents a piece of Revere as well, has said Marty Walsh is going too far, has criticized Walsh, which is odd, considering they have a pretty tight relationship. But more incredibly to me, let me read the first line from Andrea Estes and Sean Murphy's piece in the Globe the other day. One of the owners of Land and Everett, where Stephen wants to build a casino, is refusing to sign a promise that no secret owners would profit from the sale, raising questions about whether a convicted felon is still involved and potentially imperiling the entire $1.3 billion project. Poll came out yesterday, 59% of Bay Staters still support casinos, even though most of them don't want it in their hometown. Are these just blips on a screen, or do these suggest that we move too far too fast on the casino front, Peter?
No, I mean, you know, Everett is the New Jersey of Massachusetts, I guess. You know, the Sopranos reign supreme there. Listen, Walsh has played this beautifully. I mean, there's very little legal standing, having talked to a couple of lawyers about this, to what he's saying. But politically, I mean, he hit maybe not a home run, but a triple. I mean, he's just sort of manufactured this case. And I do think it's brilliant. And as a Boston resident, I appreciate what the mayor's doing here. He's talking common sense that no casino can operate without it having an impact in Boston. He's trying to make an omelet out of the scrambled eggs. Whether it works or not, I don't know. I would take DeLeo's comment as a sort of polite shot across the mayor's bow, saying, hey, nice going, Marty, but let's remember, in this issue, I may have more power than you do.
By the way, I don't think, you know, you say it's such a creative, brilliant strategy. My take on this is the following. If Revere got to vote on what happened in East Boston, if you remember, and East Boston voted no, Revere voted yes, and then Revere had to vote again, why should East Boston not have comparable status when it comes to a potential casino in Revere? Forget Everett for the moment, but what's good for the proverbial goose is good for the whatever, no?
You have a law degree and I don't.
Barely. I have a law degree.
I think you're right. I might have been engaging in a little hyperbole. I really think Walsh is playing this very, very well.
Here's my totally uninformed, a wildly uninformed analysis of this, Farrah Stockman. If it turns out that the leaders on Beacon Hill had this to do all over again, they wouldn't do it. This casino thing. I know it's a lot of money, and I know you don't have to raise taxes to get the money, which they love. Deval Patrick used to, in our studio, and he's here once a month, and I'm paraphrasing, he used to call it, you know, a critical jobs thing, huge jobs. A couple of months ago, we broached some of these issues with him. He said, I never said it was my number one jobs creating strategy. It's a recreational thing. It creates some jobs. People are, I mean, it's sort of buyer's remorse, is it not, to a degree?
I don't know. I never completely understood it. I never understood
you mean
exactly
the embrace
why.
Of casinos?
Yeah, why they did it. And with the voters, it reminds me a little bit about the marijuana dispensaries. It's like everybody likes the idea of it, as long as it's not in my town, as long as it's not in my backyard. So, I mean, I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see where it actually comes out. But do you really think that these developers would have chosen Everett or Revere if they weren't near Boston, if they weren't near Logan Airport?
That's exactly what Marty Walsh's point is.
Right.
Boston, in their ads, they're not going to – I think he said this to us a week ago Friday. Yeah. They're not going to advertise come to the casino in Everett or Revere, which no one ever heard of, with all due respect to the communities. They're going to say come to the casino in Boston.
I do think Boston has a special case. I mean, the Gaming Commission is saying, well, everybody can just open open it up now, these other towns and other places that are neighboring communities can just claim host community status. I mean, in reality, Boston probably is a special case, but where do you draw the line?
You know, one of the things I love in this Andrea Estes, Sean Murphy story, where they're talking about the one of the landowners in Everett, where Wynn wants to build a casino, of course, won't sign a promise that no secret owners would profit from the sale. And then you read that this particular co-owner has gotten in trouble already for misleading commission investigators about the role of one particular gentleman with a four-page rap sheet from Massachusetts. What do you think? You know, it does kind of feed into the stereotype of who's involved, whether it's in the land or working there behind the scenes.
Hey, listen, before this is over, we're going to find out that Vladimir Putin is a secret partner.
And he'd probably get the casino, too.
What I want to know is how those guys knew to buy that land 4 years ago. How did they know to buy that land?
That's a great question.
Can
you write down all these questions we're doing, Farah, and then we'll get back to them at some point in Monza?
Maybe when the person with the rap sheet was talking to some one of his associates when he was doing due diligence to acquire that rap sheet.
You know, we should put this in context, by the way. The Supreme Judicial Court, I assume, imminently is going to make a decision about whether or not there will be a question on the November ballot of this year, which would allow the people in Massachusetts either to say, I'm fine with the law, let's continue it, or to repeal the whole thing and start all over again with the new governor in 2015.
So moving on to Scott Brown now.
Yes, we are.
Well, we're moving on to Scott Brown because, of course, Scott Brown is running up in New Hampshire against Jean Shaheen, the incumbent. And this is a great story, Michael Levinson's story, talking about how you do have the stereotype that everybody in New Hampshire has lived there forever and they just move north, you know, from the Plymouth Rock or whatever. And the story points out that 2/3 of New Hampshire adults were born in another state and 1/4 of them were born from Massachusetts. And the thinking being that all this movement and this mobility could be a good thing for Scott Brown because a lot of the Massachusetts voters say residents say they moved out of Massachusetts, went to New Hampshire for lower taxes and the kind of conservative stuff that Scott Brown talks about. So this could be a good thing for Scott Brown if you are inclined to like his candidacy.
Well, I think the question here is how many of those people who moved from Massachusetts, New Hampshire, how many of them are tax refugees and how many of them just like the mountains? I mean,
That could be.
That's one question. And the other question is, like, don't they have a term for us in New Hampshire? Don't they call us like flatlanders or something? Like, I mean,
that's a good one.
They have a derogatory term for us. So if you are the flatlander candidate and you're like actively reaching out to flatlanders, I don't know if that helps you. I don't know. It could be the kiss of death.
It's interesting. My wife is from New Hampshire.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Sue's from Concord, New Hampshire. Her dad, many years ago, was Secretary of State. And she's from a Republican family. So I've talked to some of her relatives, and I've asked them, and they're sort of rock rib. And it's interesting. Their attitude is, you know, sort of very New England. Well, let's see how he does.
Yeah.
See, and I think with all of these elections, we in the media are trying to act as if the election's tomorrow. It's months away. It's months away, and there's a thing called the campaign that's going to take place between now and then. And I don't think much has changed since the speculation began about, you know, whether he would finally get in the ring. You know, he's got about Jean Shaheen, the odds favor her by about 3-2, and that's about where things are. And we'll be talking about this endlessly.
But I would suggest talk about Scott Brown is the bottom line.
The odds favor 3-2 or not, he's got some pretty smart people working with him, many of whom we know, and some of whom Marjorie used to work with at the Boston Herald. And it seems to me you don't give up a prime spot on Fox and at a downtown law firm unless your infrastructure people say you have a better than 3-2 shot of being the next senator from the state of New Hampshire.
Unless he's addicted.
Well, it's possible,
too. Think about
it.
He did a grueling campaign in 2010, a grueling campaign in 2012, another grueling campaign in 2014. It's like the sheer stamina. You gotta give it to the guy. Yeah. And all against women, by the way. It's so interesting.
Yeah, that was a great piece,
Older women.
Think about it. It's unfair. He can take off his shirt for the union leader, but Jean Shaheen cannot. It is unfair.
That is a very fine point. I think there's a column in there somewhere. Can we go national for a couple of minutes here? Here is outgoing Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius talking to Andrea Mitchell yesterday on Meet the Press.
Along the way, what was your low point? Well, I would say the 8 weeks where the site was not functioning well for the vast majority of people was a pretty dismal time.
You know, even though there was physically a hug, Peter Kadzis, we're talking to Peter Kadzis from WGBH and Farrah Stockman from the Boston Globe, even though there was a hug between the president and his former Secretary of Health and Human Services, and even though he praised her to the skies, the conventional wisdom was she was a sacrificial lamb, but the conversation was, did he wait so long, too long to have a sacrificial lamb? Did he? I mean, what's your sense of, one, the departure, and two, what's the consequence, since virtually every pundit, my least favorite word, every pundit says the Affordable Care Act is going to be the centerpiece of the midterm elections?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think she is viewed today as a sacrificial lamb. I mean, it was anyone with an ounce of sense would know that her days were numbered. Her days were probably numbered, you know, even before the let's just call it the big computer glitch. You know, the person protecting her was, you know, most likely Valerie Jarrett. And if there's one person Obama's afraid of, it seems to be her.
Key advisor from back home, yeah. For those who don't know.
Whoever is the cabinet secretary in charge of this, Obamacare is going to be, you know, the central issue no matter who it is. So I think it's somewhat irrelevant.
How about you, Farrah Stockman?
I don't know how they could have played it any other way, because if she had resigned, like, in the midst of all of the turmoil over the website, it would have just been another nail in the coffin of Obamacare. And so now that they can say, oh, we have the success, you know, 7.5 million people have signed up, it's turned a corner, and then they can quietly ease her out, it's not the same as it doesn't have the same impact as it would have 2 months ago.
But yeah. You're probably right. But one of the things that drives me crazy, why aren't there consequences? Even if she's a wonderful person, and by the way, even Republicans who criticized her said that I know she did her best and all that, so I don't know if that's damning with faint praise, but why shouldn't she have been fired months ago? The thing was a disaster, even if it was not her fault. The buck has got to stop somewhere. The president's not going to fire himself. Why didn't he say, I'm sorry, I know she tried really hard. We need new leadership here. Just like Deval Patrick hired whatever her name is, Sarah Eisland from Blue Cross, to help fix this disaster of a state website.
Well, is your issue accountability, or is your issue actually getting this thing done and moving past all the...
Well, I would say I'm now talking about accountability, that there should be consequences when something that you're in charge of is such a mess. Somebody should pay a price, and I think the person should be you, Kathleen Sebelius, at the time. No, you obviously don't agree.
Well, I just think if you're the leader of an organization, something's going wrong, you have to ask yourself. I mean, it's like Olga
Roche, yeah.
Right.
Great
it's
comparison.
Like, you know,
DCF.
Yeah. Do you really want to create this huge distraction by getting rid of somebody and not necessarily have, you know, it's just a lot of turmoil and distraction when you're really supposed to be aimed at fixing this website.
See, I take a different look. I think both in Olga Roche's case and in Valerie Jarrett's case, they both should have done the decent thing and resigned. Not, they're different cases because I don't think it's Olga's fault the way I do think it's Sebelius's fault. You resign yourself. They didn't. She didn't.
If you recall, we asked Governor Patrick if Olga Roche had submitted her resignation, and I believe he said to us yes, but he had rejected it.
Well,
because
talked about
both.
This.
But see, I think both Obama and Patrick have cut from similar cloth in this regard, and they would view it as a victory. And I can understand this. They would view it as a victory for their critics if they
pushed
them out.
Yes, I agree absolutely. With that, but there's one fundamental absolutely. Difference is Deval Patrick had less than a year left when this DCF thing broke. Barack Obama had 3+ years left, which is a far more reasonable time to get new leadership if you thought that was a good idea. Many of the people who are more pragmatic than political say one of the reasons not to dump Roche is who you're going to get to come in here and fix this mess whether it's her fault or not. And you've written brilliantly about that too. That is part of the reason why she still probably has her job. Is it not, Farrah Stockman?
I would say that. I would say that. But like even Sebelius, you serve at the pleasure of the president, and if you think the president doesn't like what you're doing, you're going to leave. And mm-hmm. so I have no doubt he wanted her to stay on until it actually fixed, you know, until they could turn it into a victory.
Why do you have a weird smile on your face, Marjorie?
Because before I came down here, I watched the appearance of Kathleen Sebelius on Jon Stewart's Daily Show.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
And oh, my God.
This is earlier on,
early
right?
Early on, back in October, you know, when we were just beginning to understand the problem here, he kept asking, how many people have signed up? Well, I can't tell you that. We have 100,000s of people who've looked at the website. Well, how many of those have signed? I mean, it was just cringe-inducing.
But who's going to do better? That's the other question. When you call for someone's head and you want accountability, who can defend that?
I don't know.
Better?
In the summer, you know, the wonk blog types in Washington, D.C., would frequently comment negatively whenever Sebelius was on one of the Sunday shows or in
she
any public forum. She just didn't, it didn't seem like she had the facts of how the policy worked at her fingertips. The reason I think she stayed is she has a political constituency. You know, she has Valerie Jarrett as her protector. This isn't unusual. I mean, she was a protected political appointee who was a little light on the policy side. She's not the first semi-competent to be a...
Let that poor woman go home to Kansas.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay,
I think
can
they
we
love
move
her
on?
In Kansas.
My favorite story of the week we save for last. Jeb Bush, who is the brother of George W. Bush, who apparently is at least contemplating running for president, said one of the most incredible things, and I think wonderful things, but I have a feeling I'm in the minority, last week when he talked about illegal immigration and talked about crossing the border being, quote, an act of love. His words, act of love. Here's likely opponent, assuming that that Jeb decides to run. Here's Rand Paul, Kentucky's Rand Paul on ABC this week, responding to the act of love comment.
You know, I think he might have been more artful, maybe in the way he presented this, but I don't want to say, oh, he's terrible for saying this. If it were me, what I would have said is people who seek the American dream are not bad people.
Even however, if they came into this country illegally.
But here's what I have finished up with. They're not bad people. However, we can't invite the whole world.
That was a pretty mild comment, Farrah Stockman. As soon as I read the three words, act of love, I said end of non-campaign. He hasn't run yet. If he decides to run, he may win a primary in New Hampshire. He's not winning a primary in the South or anywhere else. But if Rand Paul is treading so lightly on this, this suggests to me he's saying, well, we did lose Latinos, 71-29,
sure.
Mitt Romney versus Obama. So maybe a softer, gentler approach is the way to go. Can you survive a comment like act of love in a Republican primary in 2015?
You can if you're going to shake up who your voters are, and maybe we're looking at a kinder, gentler Republican Party, a Republican Party that reaches out to gay people, a Republican Party that that wants immigrants. I think the Conservative Party in Canada to change their image, and immigrants in Canada are now huge Conservative voters. So I don't know. It also tells me that we elected the wrong Bush.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of critics, I should say, of W who are really enamored of. And we've mentioned before he's got a Mexican-American wife. He speaks Spanish fluently. I am still stunned that those words crossed his lips. And by the way, I'm assuming he thought about it before he said it. But he did, Peter Kazis.
Oh, yeah. No, I thought it was it was a remarkable statement, not just because of the humanity of it. But because I think it was calculated. And I think Rand Paul is an interesting candidate. I mean, he's I'm yet to be convinced that his feet are firmly on the ground, but he has done some interesting things. And the thing about the Republicans are, though, that the establishment usually gets what it wants. And, since...
We're in a Republican primaries?
Yeah. No. Ultimately, they get the nominee.
They get the next in line, but there is no next in line this time, is there?
Not since Christie went Tony Soprano, there isn't.
Well, we've asked this question repeatedly in the last couple of weeks. It appears to me from afar, and I'm not a student of Jeb Bush, people whom I respect, even those who don't support his policy, says he's a very competent guy, was a competent governor. People acknowledge that the front runner by a long shot, Hillary Clinton, is a very competent woman. But what does it say? This is the question we ask virtually every day. What does it say about American democracy, small d democracy, that if we were betting people, we'd say 2016 is going to be yet another Clinton against yet another Bush, Farrah Stockman.
I don't know. I mean, you look all around the world at the legacy families that have passed countries down from one generation to another. I don't know. We're not special.
How about it, Peter Kazis?
I think, you know, ask the Queen of England. No. I mean, I think what it is that there are political dynasties. There always have been. The Roosevelts, the Stevensons, the Kennedys. Listen, who would have thought the Bushes or the Clintons, you know, at the beginning of their runs would have made it this far? I also think it has something to do with the fact that in a modern marketing-based society, the fact that you are a known brand, a word I normally hate to use.
I'm so glad. It's my second least favorite word after pundit. I'm so glad you said that.
But this is where it's applicable. I mean, the Clintons and the Bushes are like toothpaste in a way. It's unfair to them as individuals, but they're a
imagery,
product
Peter.
Line.
Beautiful.
Okay.
Peter and Farrah, thank you.
The voices you just heard, Farrah Stockman is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Peter Kazis is WGBH's senior web editor. Thank you both for coming in. Up next, Not in My Backyard. What does it mean to cover the Boston bombings from afar? The takeaway is John Hockenberry joins us for his take on what the anniversary of the bombings looks like from a New Yorker's point of view. A conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
After the Boston Marathon bombings, The Takeaway returns to WGBH Boston Public Radio. I'm John Hockenberry. Join us for a conversation with the very determined coach of the Tufts University Marathon team, whose mission is to get every one of his runners across the finish line this year. Innovation Hub's Kara Miller and a former FEMA chief will bring us new insights about resilience from the Boston tragedy. That's on The Takeaway right here in Boston. Coming up at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, providing New England with auto service since 1955, offering over 60 auto service locations throughout New England. More information and locations available at sullivantire.com. And the Worcester Art Museum, presenting Nights, featuring works from the Higgins Armory Museum Collection and the Worcester Art Museum. This new experience celebrates the rich history and artistry of this acclaimed collection. WorcesterArt.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browder. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in studio, actually in Studio 3, is John Hockenberry. You know, he's host of The Takeaway. John's in Boston covering the Boston Marathon bombings 1 year later. John, it's really a pleasure to see you and meet you.
It's great to be here. It's great to see you guys.
You know, as I just said to John, it's my ride home. I just met the guy I listen to every day on my ride home.
I'm thinking the same thing.
It wasn't me who left all those Pepperidge Farm goldfish in your backseat.
Okay. So, John, you broadcast normally from New York, live in New York. You were in New York for 9/11. Now you're here covering the Boston Marathon. Differences, similarities? I mean, there were the two big terrorist attacks on our shores, two of them.
Well, you know, I don't actually think of 9/11 as having much to do with the Boston Marathon for a couple of reasons. I mean, the 9/11 attack was a giant global story. I mean, what I discovered being up here right after the bombing, then actually going away to Houston for 2 days and then coming back in time for the end of the manhunt, that this was a completely national story, but in a fundamentally different kind of way. There was the story of the bombing itself. There was the story of the you know, the discovery that Americans made, and particularly Bostonians made, that there were cameras everywhere, that we are able to track, you know, in a way much better than George Orwell could have imagined, the movements of people in real time, and that on CNN, the sort of Tsarnaev narrative was like emerging as the pictures were you know, increasing in resolution. Then there was the manhunt. When I was in Houston, there were a half a dozen parents and family members and runners who had come from Boston, who were in Houston, who we tracked down, but all of who told the story of the checkpoint at Logan Airport, that basically they began the investigation by what have you seen, what have you seen, what have you seen, taking people who were at the marathon aside and asking them questions. The FBI did at Logan Airport. And so we talked to a woman who had been under that questioning, worried about her son, very upset about the events, very upset about being in Houston. But it was so palpable and tangible, even in Houston. So by the time I got back on whenever it was Thursday night and cover the manhunt, you know, it was a different trauma. There was a sense of, oh, my gosh, you know, anything can happen, which was very, very different from the feeling of the bombing, which was much more like 9/11. There was this idea that there are these people loose among us.
Yep.
And, you know, that stress level had gone on for four solid days. And then just to see, you know, no traffic on the streets in Boston, the land of drivers worse than Brooklyn.
I don't think
drivers.
That's even close to true. Yeah. I lived in Brooklyn, but we could debate that another day. But John, today or tomorrow is obviously the 1 year anniversary. We know what it felt like on the 1 year anniversary here of 9/11 and the second and third anniversary. How is this scene a year after, for example, in New York City, your hometown now?
Well, you know, I tell you, I'm not a big anniversary reporter guy. I mean, I think they're obligatory. You have to kind of note the calendar. But I think that the way people cope, and you sort of notice this on anniversaries, it doesn't go along with a calendar. There are some people who are over it after a week. There are some people who are over it after a year. I mean, the governor just said to me this morning, you know, anticipating that he's got to speak tomorrow, he said, I don't know what I'm going to say. How do you add to, first of all, what the people who are injured say, the actual victims say? And then, you know, there's something so symbolic about the anniversary. I think people are doing great. I think people were doing great then, but I do think there's a kind of overemphasis on the calendar because people in very different ways move on.
But, you know, you guys have both lived in New York. I have family that's lived there. I'd never lived there myself. I grew up much closer to here. To me, there's a parochialism, and I don't mean that in a bad sense. We're a small city, Boston
is.
That's
true.
And the marathon was different because, you know, it traveled from Hopkinton. It was a family event. People would go watch it all the way from there. So everybody was kind of involved in it. But in New York, I mean, I had friends that, you know, saw the planes, but they were 20 blocks away. You know, this happened down, and so they were obviously upset. But there was a kind of like, this is New York. These terrible things happen. This is one of the worst ever. But there was a different attitude, it seemed to me, between Boston and New York. Well, much more of an embrace here in Boston of everybody's in this together, and much more of a New York, the Big Apple. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that, you know, there are two issues here. And I think the one thing that I would say is common between 9/11 and the Boston Marathon bombing is, and I've lived around the world, I think that Americans live in a bubble. I think if you go most places in the world, people are accustomed to the kind of vigilance that we've become accustomed to post 9/11, whether we're talking about a catastrophic attack, and we just had one today in Nigeria, dozens of people killed by Boko Haram. Whether we're talking about a catastrophic attack or something where two guys leave backpacks on the street, you know, which was something I was very familiar with living in Israel in the 1980s. This is the global experience. This is what the world is going through. Americans are going through it at the end of the parade in some ways of joining the 21st century. And so I think that, you know, it's difficult for us. And 9/11 is different from the Boston Marathon bombing because it was such a bizarre level of destruction, a bizarre way in which technology was hijacked, like the planes, to be used against us. And then those buildings were so symbolic. But in many ways, the marathon is just as symbolic to Bostonians.
Where do you think the American people are? You mentioned cameras before, surveillance, that sort of thing. We all saw the polls immediately after 9/11 about what kinds of liberty people were willing to give up in the names of security. And that abated a little, I think, in the intervening years. Obviously, it picked up again here. Where do you think the American people are now in this endless balancing act that everybody's trying to do?
You know, I don't know. I mean, look at Citizens United. Look at the court case about campaign financing. I mean, I do think that Americans, if they're asked to jump, you know, in a crisis, are willing to throw out the Constitution. If somebody gets on television and says, it's lockdown time, we're going to be a police state for the next week, Americans, out of a sense of terror about the fact that we're vulnerable now, I think are outrageously too willing to toss away our freedoms. It was disorienting for me to see everybody complying with the lockdown, not because it was wrong.
You're talking about here, the shelter-in-place thing?
Here, the shelter-in-place. Right. I just felt like this is too easy. This is going to come back to haunt us at some point. It was absolutely great that it happened, and Deval Patrick did not force people to do it. He invited people to do it. He asked people to do it. But if you saw on the crawl, most people learned about the lockdown, not from Deval Patrick, the governor, but from seeing the crawl on television saying, you know, Boston in state of mandatory lockdown.
Yeah.
And everyone went, okay, great.
But how about the ultimate irony that we didn't get the younger Tsarnaev until the lockdown was raised, till the shelter in place was raised? Then all of a sudden, a guy walks into the backyard, checks out his boat, not once but twice, who's lying in the boat bleeding, but the younger Tsarnaev.
Add that to the irony of all the Snowden information, the NSA surveillance. Yeah, that's prevented a lot of stuff. You know, I mean, it gives us great forensics in hindsight, but I don't know about preventing.
We're talking with John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway. He's in Boston covering the anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombing. What are you covering without trade secrets? Is there anything particular you're doing up here?
When we're here? Yeah.
Yes.
I think the strongest thing that we had on our show that I want to revisit, we're doing a lot of the same stuff. We talked to the police commissioner today. We were talking to the governor. You do a great job. You have a fantastic relationship with Governor Deval Patrick. But what we, I think, found and held on to as our piece of the story was the idea of that, do you know your neighbors? Who are they? Do you know your neighborhood? Your safety, the quality of your civic experience as a voter, as a citizen, depends on you knowing your neighbors. And, you know, the Tsarnaevs are an extreme example of what can happen if you don't know your neighbors. But what we discovered, and we opened the phones, I mean, we invite people to be a part of the conversation. We said to them, you know, what has this taught you about the idea of strangers, the idea of what your neighborhood is, what you think you know about your neighborhood versus what you know about your neighborhood? And we got a million stories. People who just went, that's the issue for me. That's the button that this Boston Marathon bombing has pushed, that down the street you don't know.
My kids, both my daughters went to school with the younger Tsarnaev, by the way, and when they saw the headlines and they first saw the pictures on, I guess it was Wednesday night, their reaction, and my younger one knew him fairly well, was exactly that, a classmate, a kid she knew when to talk to, and what do you know? And the answer is you knew nothing.
You don't know enough. I mean, I think, and part of it is it's we don't want to be, you know, the FBI for our neighbors. That's not the issue. But what if the quality of your relationships with the people in your neighborhood were such that you had much more confidence about who they were, what they were doing, when they're in trouble, when they're not, when they're close to some act of desperation, when they're not, how you can help? We've lost that in America. We don't have extended families. We don't live in communities. Our stoop culture is not very good in the summer.
No, it's not.
People wander off and do their own thing in their own hot tubs. And I think it's a problem. I think it's a real problem.
Did you ever read, what's his name? Bob Putnam's Bowling Alone, the guy from the Kennedy School?
I didn't read the book, but it's sort of crossed my path.
And it fits into this. The whole notion, for those who haven't seen it, I guess it came out maybe 20 years ago, was the notion that we literally bowl alone in whatever year, and let's say 1995 when he wrote it, there isn't the social infrastructure, whether it's your neighbors, your church, your union hall, whatever it is, we're all sort of silos, little silos
or it's
all over the place.
Mediated through a screen. It's on your Facebook page. It's not in the real world. Or, you know, in the 80s, you know, I go back that far, Walkman culture, people called it. You know, you put on your headphones, you're in your bubble. That's your world. No, that's not your world. That's a piece of a world. That's an atom of a world.
Have you investigated your neighbors more closely, John Hockenberry? That's what I wonder.
I've
been remiss
in
that.
I live in a great neighborhood.
And you know your neighbors.
Yeah, and Sandy, you know, which happened, you know, around that time. We were still recovering from Sandy when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. Boy, it totally reminded us about our neighbors.
Yes.
I was going to ask you, you're in a wheelchair, John Hockenberry.
Yeah.
We have had, not only in the marathon every year, you see all these incredible athletes in their wheelchairs that go out first. I don't know, do they do that in New York too?
Oh, sure.
Okay, well, they certainly do it in Boston. So that changed people's attitudes a lot about being athletic and being in a wheelchair. This marathon, I think, too, has, because so many people have lost limbs. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that, I think there are a lot of people who, when they have a disability, want to express their resilience in some athletic, physical way. And I think a marathon is an easy way to do it. I've run a couple of marathons in Chicago a long time ago. The technology and the equipment that you see now, the three-wheel wheelchairs for running marathons and the hand cycles that exist now. And, you know, running a marathon in a wheelchair is completely different than running it on two legs, is completely different than running it with prosthetics, is completely different if you have some sort of nerve disorder, which, or a brain injury where your whole motor control is different. So the experience is completely different with each disability. But I think it really makes a powerful statement of the diversity of our community that a marathon, which is ostensibly for the elite of the elite runners, can actually open itself up to people of dramatically different physical capabilities.
Yeah, but let's take another piece of this, which is, I think, where Marjorie was going, is that the press, at least here, and I think beyond here, well, I know beyond here, has gone out of their way to focus on the survivors and how they have struggled through what is now a year kind of thing. I've read and heard you talk about people who are scared of the wheelchair, people who avert their eyes when they see somebody in a wheelchair. Does the fact that there's so much focus on people who lost a limb or were severely injured and are trying to struggle their way back, does that help change public perception about disabled people in America, or is it just
maybe
a blip?
A little? I'll tell you what. I think the fear of wheelchairs and disability is not terribly different from the heroes in wheelchairs. These are special kinds of, you know, elaborated sorts of experiences. I think it will change when it's not a big deal for someone with a disability to be next to you somewhere, where it's not some big tragedy or ooh, what happened to him, or whoa, were you in the war, or you're a hero, or thank you for your service. I mean, people come up to me and say thank you for your service, thinking I'm a veteran, and I'm, you know, no way. So it just, ask me what the actual story is. Don't presume the story going in.
So they come up and say thank you for your service, and what
sometimes,
do you say?
Well, I just say I didn't do any service. I mean, actually, I'm old now, so nobody thinks I went to Iraq or Afghanistan.
Do people come up and say what happened?
Sometimes.
Wow.
I mean, there's lots of, when you're at an airport or something and rolling quickly to get to your gate, parents will grab their kids out of the way, like, look out! You know, it's no different than anyone running to catch a plane. I mean, they can plow into you. I think that is starting to change, but I don't think it's the hero focus or the... It's really the question of, are they amongst us, these people? And it's no different for race or anything else.
John Hockenberry, can we totally change gears before you go?
No.
I've known Marjorie for 16 years.
Yeah.
Every April 1st, and I mean without one exception.
Oh, no.
Every April 1st,
here we go.
Marjorie, like a four-year-old, plays some little prank on me. This year, this is a true story. Chelsea Mers, you know, is our lead producer.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm talking to Chelsea on April 1st, and I say, I'm not going to let it happen this year. We're sitting in the newsroom. I'm not going to let it happen. I'm ready for this. It's not going to happen. Marjorie then calls me, tells me some disastrous story about something that happened to her at the Boston Herald, which is her other job. I'm going, oh my God, here's what you have to do. You have to call the April Fools. Now, even though that's sort of puerile, I would argue, but she does it successfully.
It's totally puerile because I get him every year.
You have set the gold standard of all time with, I never did anything wrong and I won't do it again. For those who are unfamiliar, 92, is that when this was?
92.
What did you do in 1992?
I was the host of Talk of the Nation, and our producer at the time, Margaret West, came up with the idea, what if we ran Nixon for president? It was the middle of 92. There was no clear favorite. Bush was, it was not clear what was going to happen. Ross Perot hadn't entered the race at that point. And we decided to run Nixon. He was going to come in. And
Rich Little?
Rich Little to play Nixon. We got Howard Feynman of Newsweek.
Newsweek.
And we even got a pollster, a great – I can't even remember the name now of the pollster we got. So we got people to make it really, really plausible. We didn't believe people would buy it, and, of course, they did.
It was a riot.
And, yeah.
People, I never did anything wrong, and I won't do it again.
That was my favorite part.
I tell you, I was cured of that, though, by my teenage daughter.
Why?
Because I would do these pranks on them. And I'm very proud of my Nixonian prank, and I would love the alerts that you would get because you'd see it online. You know, John Huckleberry, April Fool's. I don't know if having your career associated with April Fool's is necessarily the best thing. But anyway, she decided I'm going to get Daddy, and she did an April Fool with the complete cooperation of her twin sister of saying she was pregnant.
How old was she at the time?
She's 14. And... and she comes to me with a pregnancy test thing and, like, all upset and crying. And I went, I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And I said, we can help you with this, honey. Don't worry. It's going to be fine. And she was terrified that I bought it. She went, oh, my God, I've gone too far. And I just went, I am never doing an April Fool joke again. I am cured completely.
Oh, I
that
love
was the
that.
Worst experience of my entire life.
You know what your daughter should have said to your
you
daughter?
You love that. You're sick. You're a disturbed person.
How long before she told you the truth? How long before she said April Fool? Were you going for 30 seconds, a minute, 5 minutes?
It was the longest whatever number of seconds it was in my life. She was terrified. The color drained from her face, and she said, Daddy, it's April Fool's. And I didn't even get it then. I went... Don't worry about that, sweetie. Let's talk. You know, it's like, and my other daughter, her twin, came in and said, "Dad, stop being such a jerk." You know, and I went, "Oh my God, I can't believe you did this to me."
You know what his kid said to him? "I never did anything wrong, and I won't do it again."
That's
exactly.
That's right.
John Hackenberry, it's a pleasure to have you in town. And it's great to see you.
Yeah, and the April Fool's joke. I know you don't want it to define your career, and it certainly does not. But those who haven't seen it in Toto should really Google it because it is a riot. John Hackenberry is the host of The Takeaway, which you can listen to right here weekdays at 11 o'clock and 2 o'clock. He'll be in Boston for the next couple of days covering the anniversary of the Marathon bombings. Great to meet you in person, the voice I listen to every day driving home. Up next, it is time for All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. We'll get to their take on the Teflon Revlon with 99 Lives, the Reverend, Al Sharpton. Not only that, public shaming. Is it the best way to right a wrong or not? Stay tuned for that conversation on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
So much has happened since two bombs exploded on Boylston Street last April 15th. I'm Bob C. of WGBH's Morning Edition. And this week, WGBH News looks at the people impacted in our community and the continuity of what's unfolded over the past year. All this week on WGBH's Morning Edition, on BPR at Noon with Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, and on WGBH's All Things Considered, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Museum of Science, where you can see over 2,000 species of sea life, introducing Journey to the South Pacific, a new IMAX film that takes you to the most diverse ecosystem on Earth. More at mos.org/South Pacific. And the Summer Investigative Reporting Workshop for high school students at Boston University, where students learn critical thinking and research skills, how to do in-depth reporting, interviewing, and more. necir.org/summer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us as they do every Monday are syndicated columnists, Reverend Irene Monroe and Reverend Emmett Price. He's professor of music at Northeastern University. Great to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Great to be here.
Hey.
Great to see you guys as usual. So we're going to start with this with this public shaming story, this bullying story. I'm going to give people a little bit of background on it. There was this guy who lived next door to this family with two adult adopted children with developmental disabilities, cerebral palsy and epilepsy, a husband with dementia, and a paralyzed son. I mean, we're talking about a family that's dealing with a lot of problems. And two of the adopted kids were black kids, too. And the next-door neighbor allegedly spit on the mother, threw dog you-know-what at her car. Awful stuff. So anyway, when this guy gets into court, because the neighbors have had enough, the judge orders the 63-year-old neighbor, Edmund Aviv, to hold a sign for 5 hours on a Sunday that reads, "I am a bully. I pick on children that are disabled. I am intolerant of those that are different from myself. My actions do not reflect an appreciation of the diverse South Euclid community that I live in." What do you think?
This is a great story. I mean, you know, it's 15 years of terror, Marjorie.
Exactly.
I mean, the story says 50. And my favorite part, right after you read the statement on the placard the person had to hold up, said the judge said that the signs have to be large enough for the average person to see from 25 feet away. That's a huge sign.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, absolutely.
So if this sets precedent, as we walk and drive down Boston's roads and streets, I think we're going to see a whole lot of people with big, fat placards, you know, and may say something different. But, I mean, I love this.
You know, I love it. But let me just, and I have to say this, 15 years of terror. And,
can you imagine?
And have to only for 5 hours hold up a sign. It is really nothing. But it reminded me of Nathaniel Hawthorne's Scarlet Letter.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, where the woman wears an A for adultery. And I think that, you know, that it sounds wonderful, but it is a slippery slope. That if you say, well, you do this to this person, what next? Who's the next person? And with a public agreeing to it and applauding it, I just think we can slip into, yeah, well, you know, perhaps stoning. I mean, I just worry about when you have public, you know, I don't think public humiliation solves the problem. I think the best thing that they did say is that he will go to anger management. But I do worry about it. I mean, will we wear signs now, and if we're adulterers or we're abusers or we're alcoholics or we have some sort of problem? He clearly has more than just a bullying problem.
And the guy is 62 years old, right? And
so you might not be able to change him.
But he did apologize, right, and made a statement. But I think the fact here is so many times we point the finger at our young people, right? For them not being appropriate or for them, you know, not doing, you know, what's right, quote unquote, right. And here is an example of somebody who is 62 years old who had to stand and apologize and basically make the statement.
Apologize, right. But I don't necessarily think that it will change his behavior.
I don't know. I kind of think that this is, we always talk about deterrence. I mean, usually, in many times, somebody does something really bad. They beat up their girlfriend, or they do something, or they're a bully like this guy is.
Didn't stop Remy.
That's right.
Okay.
Because
OJ.
He paid no price. He paid no price for what he did previous to this. If you knew that you were going to have to stand out there and be humiliated, instead of what they usually do is say, well, you do community service. And, of course, they never do the community service because the courts are too overwhelmed to follow up on it. So essentially they get away with it over and over again. You're not getting away with
it. Do you think that if Chris Brown held up a sign and said, look, I beat up Rihanna, I know that this is not something I should do. Do you think that would really, really tamp down his anger and his? He's just totally out
of control. Yeah, but can I tell you, first of all, the Chris Brown thing. Every time someone brings up Chris Brown, I have to mention the most frightening poll in the history of polling. High school kids in Boston were polled after Chris Brown beat up Rihanna, and 50% of the kids in Boston high schools
and
blamed
elsewhere.
Her. Right. Blamed her right. for the beating. But putting that aside, let me just say this: this public shaming thing often. Judges do it to kids, teenagers. I'm totally against that. You shouldn't be having somebody who's underage standing out on a street doing something. However, for an adult, what this says to me, and I share some of the concerns you have, Irene Monroe, what it speaks to is a judge who is using a little creativity in his, I don't know if the judge is a man or a woman. Oh, Judge Gail. Well, I don't know if that's a man or a woman either. Gail Williams Byers. Creative sentencing. Maybe it's not perfect, but essentially just stockpiling people and saying, okay, next you go to jail for 3 months. Okay, next you go on probation. You go community service. This is a judge who, in my estimation, thought creatively. Will it solve the problem? I don't know. It'll probably solve the problem in my opinion, better than just sending the guy to a can for 2 weeks. I would like to see more creative sentencing. I guess that's where I'm going. Why are you making a face at me?
Well, yeah, I just feel like, you know, soon then we'll, you know, I just think that it allows a public to feel that that's the way to change.
Okay, you sentence him. You're the judge. What do you do to this guy?
That he would seriously have to do sensitivity training because of the racial slurs.
Fine, do it both.
Anger management.
Good.
I don't think public, I think if nothing else, the humiliation angers him. You know, it reminds me of Catholic school. You know how the
you
nuns
think it may make him worse.
I think absolutely.
Well, that's a point.
Absolutely. I don't think that brings about understanding the root of his problem.
Well,
and he becomes a public spectacle.
Can you imagine living next to this guy for 15 years? I mean, talk about wanting to tear your hair out.
I applaud the woman for finally speaking out about it and having, you know, the courts come in and do something about it. If anything, I think she shows an example of what you should do.
By the way,
being bullied by an adult.
We should say that this was not the only punishment.
That's
while it didn't go quite as far as you, Irene, would like, he served 15 days in jail. He is undergoing anger management classes and counseling and whatever.
Well, let's move on. I wanted to ask you guys, I'm fascinated to see what you think about this whole situation down in Brandeis. There is a known scholar, parliamentarian from Holland, Ayaan Hirsi Ali, fierce critic of Islam, called it, is one of her worst quotes, a destructive, nihilistic cult of death. She was supposed to get an honorary degree from Brandeis. Now, she's from Somalia. She's undergone terrible tortures. I hate even to say this word, but genital mutilation there. Mm-hmm. Her family tried to force her to marry against her wishes. Then she went to Holland. She was in the Dutch parliament, wrote the screenplay for Submission, which is a piece critical of the treatment of Muslim women. Many of us remember that the director of that
was killed.
He was murdered on an Amsterdam street with a threat to this woman, Hirsi Ali. So in any case, long story short, she was offered an honorary degree. The you-know-what hit the fan, and the offer was rescinded. Do you think Brandeis was right to do this, to take away the honorary degree?
Well, I mean, Brandeis can do whatever Brandeis wants to do. I want to know who made the invitation, right? I mean, so vet the people invite to, you know, one of the most prestigious ceremonial, you know, of distinction. That
you don't
you
know
give
who
somebody?
Vetted her? The same people who vetted the medical marijuana dispensaries in the same.
And we're still doing this, right? I mean, you know, it's embarrassing, right? Because you have to wait till the bloggers make a big deal about it. You have to wait till a public petition or change.org or change.com, you know, and then all of a sudden it's like, whoops.
She's a conservative star, and she's written, you know, prolifically about fundamentalism, Islam. I think the difference between her and, say, the young woman that has written the book and we've all come to love, Malala, is this. You know, she constantly says in the root of Islam is violence, as opposed to Malala and her father, who says, no, it really isn't. It's how we read the scripture, what we read into Islamic scripture that allows us to, you know, in many ways act out a political agenda. She's the, you know, so what happens is that she paints this iconic image and feeds into a conservative, you know, in some way, jihad that believes in Islam being, you know, a violent religion.
I don't want to upset you, but by the way, you know who had a message not dissimilar from Malala, even though maybe not as articulate? George W. Bush. I mean, Bush's position was there's a terrorist faction of Islam, not that all of Islam or all Muslims should be indicted because of the behavior of some. And by the way, the issue that's arisen here, I mean, you work in a university. Yeah. The issue is, you know, the free speech thing. What was the name of Harvey Silverglade's great Shadow University about the lack of free speech? The issue to me, the president of the school has specifically invited her back, to his credit, to say, if you want to engage in a dialogue with students and faculty here, it's great. There's a difference between allowing someone to speak on a campus, which I think you have an obligation to do of all points of view,
absolutely.
And giving someone an honorary degree. So for those who are, in my opinion, falsely saying this is yet another example of people squelching free speech, this is not that situation.
Not at all. This is an issue, again, of bad protocol. Academic integrity, academic freedom, you know, intellectual freedom. The university campus should be, if not the, you know, one central place, but one of the main places where you can hear all sides of any story, any perspective. So I'm fine with that.
Have you heard her speak, though? I mean, in many ways, it's quite incendiary. There's a level of it that, well, she's quite articulate and well-educated. There's a part of it is just inflammatory. Yeah. It really is.
Sure.
Nihilistic culture of death.
It defaces not only Islam, but our intelligence. But the opposing, in terms of how she does not nuance.
The opposing viewpoint probably sounds that, inflammatory to her.
It's sort of like, God forgive, he's gone on. But if we invited Jerry Falwell to Harvard, and we didn't do the vetting, in many ways, you would have to rescind that invitation because, he would say in many ways that scripture is violent, the whole notion of an eye for an eye. But that's not what we uphold.
Yeah, but Irene Monroe, the place where I disagree with you is a lot of people were really upset. I hope I get this all right. And if not, one of you correct me. Remember when the prior president of Iran was invited to Columbia? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were saying, how dare Columbia give a forum to this Holocaust-denying killer. And if you'll recall, the president of Columbia, yeah, excoriated this guy, yeah, with some of the... Remember, one of his... We don't have any homosexuals in Iran.
In Iran, right.
I mean,
that's
he made
right.
a total fool of right. this guy. And so my view is, if you have a platform, I mean, whether we like it or not, he was president of Iran. Whether one likes it or not, this Ali woman has some standing. The answer is give her a forum and allow people with better ideas to have them prevail.
You're the academic over here, Emmett Price. Mm-hmm. I want to be clear on this. My understanding is when you get an honorary degree, it's to recognize the body of your work. And mm-hmm. she was just going to be on the stage. She wasn't going to be giving a commencement address or anything, right? I mean, it's a different deal. That's what I thought was problematic here, because they were recognizing the body of her work.
But why would you recognize it? See, I mean, that's the problem.
Well, that's
the
what
body
I'm saying.
Of her work is problematic.
It would be different, but I'm saying it's different than her coming to Brandeis and giving a speech.
Yeah. I don't see
read
the difference.
I read what she wrote in the Wall Street Journal. Now, that was after all this controversy sprung up, and it was not nearly as inflammatory as what I expected. It was mostly about women being,
whether you agree with the perspectives that she proposes or espouses, the fact that she's a woman in this hostile situation, the fact that she has endured the things
horrible.
That she's endured, and the fact that she's risen up amongst her population of people as an icon, if you will, I think that's what was being celebrated and that was being signified. So
I want to be clear before we leave this. I thought we had an agreement earlier on, not that we have any power to agree on anything, that it's one thing to give her an honorary degree, and I'm looking at you, Irene Monroe, here, which shouldn't have been done. But, invite her on the campus and let her speak. You don't even think the latter was appropriate for her?
No, I don't. I really don't, because of what Brandeis stands for. And I think it's an insult to the Islamic scholars that are in the religion mm-hmm. department there to have this woman receive an honorary degree.
No. I mean, I'm not talking about an honorary degree.
Absolutely.
Oh, you're fine with that?
No, I'm not. I'm not. No,
don't allow her on the campus at all.
No, any more than I would be. I wouldn't want Jerry Falwell on Harvard's campus.
Well, send Jerry Falwell to Northeast, and I'd like to have him on the
campus. Well, you can't. He's going on to glory. But
speaking of Jerry Falwell, how do you think he'd feel about this news story that we're going
to
mention next?
Before we get to Jesus' wife, what was the Teletubby that he was so concerned was gay? Remember that?
Oh, yeah, the purple one.
That's right.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Tinky Winky.
I mean, how embarrassing.
That was in the Wall Street Journal, by the way.
Smackdown, Tinky
and
Winky.
He has a body of work too, but I mean that's
he has
not
a
something
body
to be
of work.
Lauded.
Well,
okay.
Except for, we can have we can continue that discussion
well,
in other contexts another day.
We should do this over at Whole Foods in the hot bar where I usually meet you.
And that's where I spend most of my non-radio time, actually.
Really.
So as you know, there was a big controversy about whether this little piece of papyrus that purported to had Jesus mentioning his wife was a fake or not.
By the
fake.
Way, discovered by a local person.
Yes,
Harvard
University.
Carrie King, a very well-known.
Yes.
New Testament scholar at Harvard Divinity School.
And
I'm
now
sorry,
apparently
Margaret.
it's from 800 and not 400 or something. But mm-hmm. I guess what I want to know is you guys are both reverends.
On a good day. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
All right.
If it were proven that Jesus Christ had a wife, Would this be the end of Christianity as we know it, Emmett
Price? No.
It would flourish even more.
One of the things that we have to realize is the mysteries of the gospel, right? So nobody knows everything about what happened. We are as much archaeologists as we are theologians, as we are homileticians, for those of us preach. And so the reality is we're always trying to construct the best that we know based on the information that we have. So I, for one, I'm so excited when we uncover, you know, different relics and pieces like this.
Text.
You know,
yeah, absolutely.
Gnostic gospel.
When they go through the testing to figure out, you know, from whence they come and whatnot, and whether Jesus was married or Jesus was not married, I don't think this is anything that changes the notion of the relevancy of the gospel, of the Bible. I think this is beautiful. I think this is an opportunity for us to explore and see all the things that we really don't know.
Well, see, the big issue to me is that we don't want to say that Jesus had a wife, because his evangelizing really with 12 disciples clearly points out that he wasn't a family man. We don't want to say he's gay, although scriptures are pretty emphatic. It was Jesus and just the 12 boys. And it clearly, if you're hanging out with 12 guys, the laws of average clearly suggest that at least one of those brothers were gay. And we know that the scripture never mentions Jesus saying anything negative about homosexuality. And one of the reasons, because the scripture talks about Jesus' beloved disciple, John.
Yeah.
So a hermeneutic suspicion really clearly begs the question, how did he love John? And more importantly, how did John love Jesus? And we don't want to say Jesus was married to Magdalene. I just have to say this, who is thought of as the second most important woman in the New Testament scripture after Mary, the mother of Jesus. Mm-hmm. But the misogyny, I have to say, come on now, written in the patriarchal narrative of Jesus' narrative, casts her as a whore.
Wait a minute. So, I thought we established that she was not a prostitute. Haven't we changed our mind about that?
Well,
that she was certainly
one of his disciples. Many have suggested that she bankrolled his ministry, but what is very clear that Mary Magdalene was his go-to girl for a whole lot of things.
I thought maybe she was the wife.
Okay, wait
you
a
know,
second.
She was hanging around. She was there when he was on the cross.
And another thing, just let me say this. And when we really put Jesus in historical and religious context, we have to remember this. He was a rabbi. You come from the Jewish tradition,
I
right?
do come
okay,
from the Jewish
and
tradition. Thank you for
in his
that.
Time, as well as in this time, are married men with children.
I
and
was
some
number
with
one in my bar mitzvah class.
Okay.
By the way,
so I just refuse that an itinerant rabbi.
Okay, Irene. Jeez.
Okay.
This is not like a lecture here. Let me ask both of you a question before we wrap this baby up here. Pope Francis, to his credit,
I'm sticking by that story.
Pope Francis has given a ton of interviews. Someone puts a mic in Pope Francis's face today and says, "Pope Francis, if it turns out that this is real, mm-hmm. and if, in fact, it turns out that Jesus did have a wife, what does that mean for the Catholic Church? What is Pope Francis' response to that, Emmett Price?
I mean, his response is going to be, let me get back to you on that. I mean, because it's such a heavy question. I mean, it's absolutely a heavy question.
Changes everything.
It changes everything from the praxis of Catholicism. I mean, you know, because you have the patriarchal lineage, which, you know, Irene has mentioned over, you know, time
Don't
and time
again. Don't get her started
again.
That's why I'm looking at you, Jim.
Right. We already heard Irene 3:16, okay. And it was quite a good scripture.
Okay. But I expect the Pope. I would like the Pope to say, and I do too.
Okay. Yeah.
I have one too.
Yeah.
Whoa.
One last thing on this, because you guys are both reverends. It was pretty unusual. I mean, he was 30 years old before he did anything besides build the tables and chairs and stuff like that. The pressure would have been huge on him to get married.
Well, I mean, there's
a whole lot of
stuff that happened between 11 and 30, you know, leading up to 33. So, again, that's the piece where I say the mystery of the gospel. We don't have the complete story.
He was just hanging around Nazareth there.
It's not a mystery. It's just hidden text, and it's deliberate to sort of promulgate a certain kind of political bent.
Did you hear?
Really?
You didn't hear the way Marjorie put that? He wasn't doing anything except building, I don't know, like tables and chairs until all of a sudden.
He was a carpenter. He only preached for 3 years, right? So he was doing other things.
Oh, he's done more than that, Marjorie. Well, please. And sex is one of them.
Okay, sex.
Really? I mean, really? And just the thought of the 12 boys.
Welcome to Holy Week.
Yeah, we heard about the
12 boys.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
I mean, really?
Okay, the email's coming in fast and furious.
I'm sticking by my story, too.
The Reverend Irene Munro is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at Bay Windows and the Huffington Post. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture, Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. wild, wild and woolly in here today with the two reverends. Thanks for coming up. Up next, the French have always been celebrated for their great restraint, from their emotions to their portion control. Now you can add emails to the list. The French are now considering limits on work emails and phone emails. Is this a restriction you could get behind? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
They say that some folks have never seen Ireland for themselves. Well, what are you waiting for? Join me, Brian O'Donovan, this October for an Irish sojourn through the scenic southwest of Ireland, a place so lush and green, you'll understand why they call it the Emerald Isle. We're also bringing legendary singer-songwriter Robbie O'Connell along for the ride. But space is limited. Please visit wgbh.org/learningtours for more information.
We love our contributors. That means you.
And the Boston Philharmonic. You can join Maestro Benjamin Zander and the Boston Philharmonic for Mahler's Transcendent Ninth Symphony, Friday, April 25th in Symphony Hall. Details at bostonphil.org. And Subaru of New England, offering the new Subaru XV Crosstrek Hybrid with symmetrical all-wheel drive. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. More information available online at subaruofnewengland.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Now, if you're among the working people who think it'd be impossible to get your work done if you weren't plugged in all the time, fielding emails and texts, how would you feel if your employer imposed limits on when you could be on the grid? I know you think that's impossible, right? Wrong. It is happening in France, where labor unions and corporate representatives have agreed on, quote, an obligation, listen to this, an obligation to disconnect from remote communication tools. The idea is to give workers 11 hours of rest every day. That means no emails, no phone contact, no nothing, a complete disconnect from work. We want to know at 877-301-8970. What do you think? Can you imagine truly being off the clock for 11 hours a day? Could you get your job done? Or would you get canned by the end of the week? Let me admit that the answer to both those questions for me, Marjorie, is yes, meaning it would be absolute heaven, and at first, at least, it'd be impossible because you think if you're not in communication with your coworkers, your bosses, your staff, your team all the time, you can't do anything. But ultimately, you get from here to there. I think this is so enlightened and so terrific in the age of 24/7 contact. I cannot believe
it. No, I absolutely love it too, but I think the expectation has become that you do take your work home and you are spending the evening catching up on the emails you didn't have time to answer during the day, and you are with your cell
phone. But why do you do it? Why do you do it? Because if you do, you're not seen as a committed worker. If the law of the land, as it's about to be in France, once whatever agency signs off on this, signs off on it, if the law is that an employer may not communicate with you for 11 hours a day. Every business can set its own 11 hours. It can be from 10 p.m. to 9 a.m., from 6 p.m. to whatever that comes out to, 5 a.m. the next morning. They set those 11 hours, and you are free.
Listen,
I mean, it is a dream.
I think it's terrible what's happened to us in the last 15 or so years, where people feel like they are on 24/7, and they have to be working 24/7. And you hear about people coming back from their vacations because something happens at the office. It's just absolutely insane. I think it's terrible.
Listen to the opening of this New York Times story. This is the first paragraph of the story where I first read it. Dateline Paris. Given France's 35-hour work week, generous vacations, and persistent, if not altogether accurate, reputation for indolence, it may come as a surprise that the French are only now considering limits on the work emails and phone calls that come all hours of the day and night. We want to know if you think it'd be workable in certain parts of this country and if it's something that you think time has come. 877-301-8970
is the phone number. How many people do you know that go to work every day, they come home, they have dinner with the kids or whatever, and then they spend the evening doing more work? I mean,
or at least checking to see if there is more work, if you've gotten an email or you've gotten a phone call to which you should be responding.
Yeah, and I think that ever since the recession, it's just been exaggerated tremendously because people are so worried about losing their jobs or holding on to their jobs, and everyone is doing more with the same amount of money or just slightly less money. I mean, it's just you feel that we're really somewhat oppressed workers here in the United States of America. And you read about these studies that say about how even though we have, you know, a great standard of living and we are luckier than a lot of other countries, the anxiety level in America just keeps going up and up and up. And I think part of what you're anxious about is you're working all the time. You don't have time to, like, do the normal things. You know what you see all the time now? You see people at the – this is a little bit off topic, but not totally. You see people with their kids at the park on their cell phones.
It's not off topic at all.
Yeah.
It is not off topic at all. You've got to
so
be connected 24/7.
My kids are old enough that I didn't have my cell phone with me at the park because there weren't – well, there were cell phones then, but I didn't take it with me because the expectation was you were not reachable 24/7. That's the part that drives me crazy. You're reachable 24/7.
Here's one more paragraph from the New York Times story. French labor law is highly protective of worker rights, but – and here's the key – businesses and even some officials in the French government say this new proposal, this potential law, is a significant impediment to economic growth. So would it be an impediment to economic growth, or would it lead to the increased health and sanity of the average American worker? And by the way, you don't have to call and say, well, in my industry, it wouldn't work because of so-and-so. I'm sure there's certain industries. This doesn't apply to every French worker. It's 250,000 consultants and technical people just to start. But wouldn't it be great to have an experiment in the United States to see if certain industries could free their people to have lives and not be anxious all the time, like Marjorie is talking about?
Jack just sent in an email saying, Jim sees a new mandate coming, ready
well,
to pass
fine.
The law.
But by the way, you know what? The reason we need laws in these kinds of situations is because neither employees, because they're worried about competition from other employees, or employers who take advantage in many cases, can't control themselves. And by the way, that's when government has to step in, when businesses and the people who work there can't regulate their own behavior, then you have a situation like they have in France, which I have to say I think is so overdue, it's ridiculous.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, or bpr@wgbh.org. By the way, did you mention Volkswagen already?
Nope.
Listen to this. In 2011, Volkswagen started shutting off its BlackBerry servers at the end of the workday, stopping some employees in Germany from sending or receiving emails. Isn't that great? Last year, the German Labor Ministry ordered its supervisors not to contact employees outside the office hours. The German Labor Ministry ordered its supervisors. So that's pretty impressive, I think. And the German economy is humming along quite well, isn't it?
It is. It is. And by the way, again, some piece of the French government has to sign off on this for it to happen. But apparently, it is imminently going to happen. 877-301-8970. Can we take a couple of phone calls here,
people? Yes, we can take a couple of
phone calls. Is anybody ready on that? I see calls, but there we go. Let's go to Devin. You're in Somerville. You're first on Boston Public Radio. What do you think of the idea, Devin?
I think it's a great idea. I think we need to, get off the clock sometimes and relax. It's necessary, I think, to avoid burnout, really.
Well, and also to keep you mentally healthy and sane and actually allow you to enjoy your existence. Are you in the kind of industry, do you do the kind of work where this would be feasible?
Actually, that's a good question. I'm a musician. I do a lot of work freelance.
Oh.
So, I do work as an independent contractor as well. And so I'll receive emails, for example, and the subject line is urgent. Well,
everybody who sends an email thinks it's urgent, whether it's urgent or not. Devin, thank you for your phone call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. It would require a complete cultural shift. And again, the only way it's going to happen, I know the emailer joked about yet another government mandate that Jim loves, it's because we couldn't do it ourselves. We don't have the self-control, neither the employers nor the workers in most of America
I'm trying to think about how long it's been that everybody's been like wired up with their cell phones.
15 years, I don't know.
15 years.
Maybe.
So we managed to really do quite well before we were wired 24/7 to take our cell phones with us every single solitary place we went, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah,
we did.
Great.
But that's this is the new world order, and it would be
the new world order.
I mean, but that is the reality. Is can you imagine a circumstance in which there could be voluntary agreement to do this? No, there might be isolated circumstances. But I mean, I would celebrate. I would embrace any candidate who did this kind of thing to create better life. You never are. If you're never off the clock, you can never relax. You're never at peace. There's always, you know, that sort of slight vibration in your body where you're never like turned off kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
I see you vibrating from here.
Well, you know what I mean. I mean, it is really tough. I'm not clear what the deal is with the phone calls here. Are they takeable or they're untakeable? Gentlemen and ladies,
we don't know.
Can you help us out? Omar, you're in Lawrence.
Hi,
we actually have the mayor of Lawrence in about 5 minutes here. Omar, thanks for the call. Hi.
Hi. I'm a huge fan, by the way.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thank you.
Interestingly enough, I became a fan on a job that actually is responsible for my incapacitation. I'm dealing with a permanently split disc, old disc in my lower back. The reason being was it was a pressure related to the performance that we are supposed to be keeping up. I work in a sort of parcel delivering office supplies, mm-hmm. and I was trained to always keep in mind of our performance review. I'm about 135 pounds, and I was going out with 3,000 to 4,000 pounds worth of material a day that I would have to complete, within 10 to 12 hours, depending. So I was working a lot of overtime. I wanted to get it done. I pushed my hardest to be able to deal with a 250-pound load on my hand. Could not do it. And actually, my disc had bulged in a previous accident back in December. I didn't know, and through my own exercise regime, I kind of pushed it back in place. And anyway,
So Omar, you think, I assume then, based on this horrific experience, that this would be a great idea
I definitely would. I know I heard in France is more particularly with consultants and techs where you're obviously dealing with phone calls and emails and such. And
consulting, computing, and polling firms are the first 250,000 people with whom they're doing this thing.
Omar.
Exactly. Yep.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the call. And I hope
we wish you improvement.
Wish you well and your health issues, Omar. Thank you for calling.
877-301-8970. Yeah.
Okay, Amy says she was on call 24/7 for 11 years. The only time she was not on call is when she left the country. And Carol from New Hampshire says she leads tours to France, and she tells her travelers to leave their machines at home. And they are very upset about it at first, but at the end of the two-week trip, they say it was so relaxing, and she reminds them that there are still telephones.
Do you have any friends, by the way, who were on call all the time? I don't mean someone like a doctor who does emergencies, but someone doing I do have friends, particularly in the computer industry, and you can go out to dinner with them, they're anxious. You can go to their house, they're anxious because they're always waiting for the thing to ring or buzz or vibrate or something. And even when it doesn't, even when they don't intrude in your life, you're thinking about them intruding. It's just a mess. This is a great idea. France is ahead of the curve. I know we like to make fun of the French policy vis-a-vis its workers, but I think this one's pretty enlightened. Dave, you're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, David.
Yes, I'm a physician and personally think I want to be on call 24/7.
You do.
But not all. I had a run-in with my supervisors, actually was spoken to by the highest levels of administration at UMass, telling me that was unhealthy of me to be on call 24/7. I needed the time off, and I had to sign out at 5 p.m., except on the nights I was on call. I had to sign out at 5 p.m., and they would check to make sure I did.
And wait, at the end of the day, do you agree that they were right?
No, I left that job. I will not be unavailable at night. But there is an honest debate, even in healthcare, which most people, myself included, would think should be immune to such a restriction.
Well, David, let me. Maybe this is where the debate is, and this is meant in the most respectful way. If I, as a patient, had a choice between having somebody who hasn't been on call every single day, 24/7, as opposed to a physician who's had one or two nights or weekends or whatever where they turn the beeper off, they turn the phone off so they can actually have a life and relax, aren't I wise to choose the latter physician if I could?
That's one argument, but my opinion is I would much rather reach the doctor who knows me. And then
that's a good point, too.
And that doctor should protect his own mental health to make sure that his workload is not so great that he goes crazy with the beeper on his belt.
And are you able to, I mean, since you sound like you're someone very loyal to your patients, are you able to police yourself to the point where you don't go overboard?
I spend a lot of time thinking about that, and it's a constant struggle because there are always demands for you to be too busy. But I put a priority on limiting my responsibilities, and then I'm totally responsible to them.
David, you're a thoughtful doctor. Thank you so much for the call.
Lauren in Brookline, would you like the world if you didn't have to check your emails and take phone calls from the office after hours? What do you think, Lauren?
I think that would be great. I think that it's pretty hard for parents who work full-time my husband and I have two sons, and we have homework to deal with, and we don't want to have our kids have too much digital time, and you get pressure from from teachers and doctors saying that they're not supposed to have more than an hour of digital time, and you need to sit down and have a family dinner. And it's just like there's pressure on all sides. And I think it would be great to have a change in the culture.
Lauren, there was a great...
feel like they have to do it.
There was a great story, because you're a mom with small children. There was a great story in the Wall Street Journal. This is when everybody had Blackberries. This is before everybody moved into the smartphones and the iPhones and all that kind of stuff, about the kid taking mom's so-called crackberry and throwing it in the toilet. I think he said that it was – I forget if it was the son or the daughter, but the kid was so sick of her parents looking away from helping them with the homework or reading the story or whatever and checking the BlackBerry. And this is a dilemma for anybody with small kids, right? If your office is contacting you all the time, it's like the message to the kids is...
Like father, like daughter.
You don't count.
Like,
you don't count. You only care about your office.
Also,
mom.
Why shouldn't you emulate the behavior of that parent you're talking about? So, Lauren, you sound exhausted by it, are you?
You're trying to do a good job, and, but it's sort of like there's no give anywhere. But that's what my kids are like. Well, if we don't do digital time, then you can't do it either.
Yeah, that's right.
I've heard that in the past.
Say as I do, not as I say, or do as I say, not as I do, whatever it is.
Hey, Lauren, thank you. We wish you luck. Thank you very much for the call.
Okay, I think we are moving on at this
point. We are.
Yes, because we are joined, and we're excited to talk to him, too. The new mayor of...
Oh, he's not here yet?
Oh, he's not here
yet. We're going to be joined in a few minutes.
He's not here. Okay.
With Mayor Rivera from Lawrence. But in the interim, we can take a few more calls. Our apologies. Jeff, you're in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the whole 24/7 kind of culture is just a further extension of corporations looking to get more time from people without paying for it, such as unpaid interns. I have a niece who went to a job interview recently, and they asked her to provide a presentation of how she would fix their marketing department. So... there's all kinds of ways that corporations are trying to get work done without paying for it. And apparently the wage and hour laws are not enforceable.
It's different if you're a salaried employee versus, what do they call them, professional or whatever it is. There are different standards. But the interesting thing in the French experience, Jeff, is you would think that corporate leaders would oppose this policy. They're part of the deal. And while the stories we read in the New York Times don't say this, I'm assuming, because they're convinced that there is a healthier worker and a more productive workforce if people get some downtime. So, you know, hopefully that spirit will come to America. Jeff, thank you kindly for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay, up next we
are
going to talk.
By the way, do me a favor.
What?
Don't call me. Don't email me. Don't call me.
Jim.
Don't text me.
I don't think you've taken a phone call of mine in about 7 years.
Yeah, but I might someday. And so just in case
okay.
I'm thinking
I've
of doing
of
it,
given
don't
up,
place it.
You know, I text. Maybe I'll get
I'm
lucky
you right
and you'll
now.
Text me back, but I wouldn't bet on it.
No.
Anyway,
don't
Lawrence Mayers and Rivera joins us next to talk about his first 100 days in office. That conversation on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A year after the Boston Marathon bombings, The Takeaway returns to WGBH Boston Public Radio. I'm John Hockenberry. Join us for a conversation with the very determined coach of the Tufts University Marathon team, whose mission is to get every one of his runners across the finish line this year. Innovation Hub's Kara Miller and a former FEMA chief will bring us new insights about resilience from the Boston tragedy. That's on The Takeaway right here in Boston. Coming up at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Innuendo in Natick presenting the Hunter Douglas Celebration of Light Window Fashions event featuring Hunter Douglas Duet Arcatella Silhouette and Vignette Shading Systems available with Light Rise Cordless Upgrade, innuendo.com. And Pioneers of Television, Stand Up to Sitcom. See how some of America's top stand-up comics made the transition from the stage to sitcoms. Watch Pioneers of Television, Tuesday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie again. Here with us in Studio 3, we both wanted to meet him, is Lawrence Mayer Dan Rivera. His business card reads, I love this, City of Lawrence, Mayor and CEO. And yes, Mayor Rivera does mean business. He's intent on creating jobs, reducing poverty, beefing up the police force, and improving schools. Part of sprucing up the city's image, Marjorie and I talked about this maybe a month ago, comes down to cleaning up the image of his own employees. Mayor Rivera has implemented a dress code for city workers, which requires that all men wear ties, which explains why I was turned down as the mayor's press secretary as my work uniform just today. 3-day stubble, T-shirt with an unbuttoned flannel over it, and socks or no socks. That depends. Despite that rejection, Mr. Mayor, it's a pleasure to meet you. You just finished 100 days in office. How are you, Mayor Rivera?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you guys for having me on.
We're thrilled to have you.
And
Any,
Dan,
go ahead.
May I say, you look spectacular. He is in a lovely blue tie and a blue blazer. And I'm with you on this. I think in City Hall, I mean, Jim does look a little grungy over here, but usually people don't see him. But when you go into City Hall, whether it's to pay a parking ticket or whatever, I want to see people. I don't want to see, you know, T-shirts.
Yeah, no, it's – when you think about it, we pay so much in taxes, right? And so much of it goes kind of unseen. Well, we see police. We see the roads getting fixed. We see firefighters. But we see so much that doesn't go unseen. And the one thing you do see, if you go do something in City Hall, you see the people that get paid do the tax return. And you don't want to see people to be unshelled. You want people to look, take pride in their work. And conversely, what I tell people in the hall is, like, you want to have a good – interaction when somebody comes in the hall. You want to have a positive interaction. So when they say, wow, you know what, I went to Lawrence, and though I had to pay a parking ticket, people were really nice to me, and they all looked very professional. I know if you live in, maybe if you live in a community where your hall is, your city hall is very, you know, in the new century, it has a lot of computers, and you can do stuff online, you think this is kind of silly. But if you go to, more than not, if you go to the city or town hall, we're not really up to date in the way we appear to people and the way we interact with people. You know, towns, I don't want to mention any towns or cities' names. I don't want to hurt anybody. But Lawrence, you know, we still do a lot of stuff on paper. So we, you know, we're just kind of getting into this theme where, you know, we got to be customer facing.
Mayor Rivera, I don't know if this is Barney Frank's line. I don't know who said this, but somebody clever said it. Is the good news you won. The bad news is you have to serve. And so you beat an incumbent who a lot of people think was corrupt. One of his staff people has been convicted of a crime and others indicted, I believe I have that right. And this is Willie Lantigua. I think the highest poverty rate of any city in the Commonwealth.
Yeah.
Unemployment, mid-double digits, mid-teens. This is a really tough job. You've been doing this 100 days. Before you tell us what you've done, why did you want to do this? I'm serious. I mean, why did you decide you want to do something that most of us would consider to be borderline impossible?
Well, I'll tell you what. I think that I have a kind of a personal work philosophy. If you really want to solve a problem, if you have a problem you want to complain about, you have to participate in fixing that. And so, you know, I, with a lot of other people, were sick in the way people were looking at our community. You know, I'm a homeowner there. I don't just live there. I own property there, and I hope to bring my kids up in that community. And so all those things that happened, when they talk about Lawrence, you see a bad story in the newspaper, they're talking about the mayor, the prior mayor, they were talking about us. So it was very personal to me, specifically growing up in the city and knowing how much we already have to overcome being, you know, whatever the demographics are, as you can imagine. And then, you know, you read in the paper that we're the Commonwealth's basket case, or you're the, you know, we're city of the damned, or whatever it is, you just think, how am I ever going to make my money back on my property first, right? Just the pocketbook issue. And then there's a personal pride issue. You know, I'm a kid that grew up in the projects. My mom was a single mother. And, you know, I still got a chance to go to college. I went to the Army. I got a house. I'm fairly normally adjusted, except when it comes to
fairly looking. Fairly normally adjusted.
You know, but so you got to do it. And so I said, you know, if we want to change our city, we got to do it. We just can't complain about it.
But, you know, you are absolutely right. I think it does take a toll on you if you live in a place that people are poking fun at all the time. I grew up in Fall River, and Fall River's had a lot of problems. And you get the same sort of, you know, the old mills and huge immigrant population, and people are making fun of you all the time. It does take a toll.
And you know what? The cool part for me is, and I am an optimist in my heart, is that, you know, these places used to be great places.
Yeah.
You know, the former mayor used to always say the great city of Lawrence. I don't use that term. Great is a thing that somebody puts on you, not something you put on yourself. And so we always think about, we're going to make Lawrence better. And we had the biggest stone dam in the world. You get what I'm saying? The biggest stone dam made by hand in
that.
Lawrence on the Merrimack River. It's still there today. It's a great dam. So at one point in all of the world, we had the biggest stone dam. At one point, we had the biggest four-sided mill clock. We had the most factory mill brick in the world. So you think about these things, and you think, wow, if they could be that great at that time, we could do those big things. Why can't we do it today? And we just got to figure out a way to transform those places to be more. And for us to think that it's possible, you know. And that goes the same for Fall River, and I think of Fitchburg. And
why is it possible? I mean, why do you believe, and why should people of Massachusetts and, well, you're close to the border of this region, believe that while your intentions are wildly admirable, mm-hmm. that this is a winnable battle?
I guess you'd have to say that, you know, we have to win, right? We can't just, because as goes the Lawrences of this country, goes the country. I mean, there's more countries between the population, I think as somebody said the other day, was between 50,000 and 200,000. And there's only 9 1 million plus cities in the country. So we are the basically what cities look like in America. So if we can't figure out Lawrence or New Bedford, Fall River, Erie, you know, all these other places, we got a problem. And we have the infrastructure. The cool thing is we have the infrastructure to bring back manufacturing, to bring back the textile industry. We have it better. You can't build a big enough building on 128 on 495 the way we already have to kind of hold on to a new manufacturing base.
You know, I wondered, Lowell did this a long time ago when Paul Tsongas was the senator of Massachusetts, and he was obviously from Lowell. They refashioned a lot of those old mills and turned them into pretty cool housing, because they're on the river up there in Lowell. You're on the river there in Lawrence. Is that sort of a ridiculous pipe dream for Lawrence or what?
I think it's a different – we're trying to figure out who we are on the Merrimack, right? So Lowell has the Tsongas Arena. It has the Lowell Auditorium, as UMass Lowell. There's a lot of things there, and I think that they're – you know, rightfully so, can be called the arts cultural center north of Boston. We don't want to compete with that. They have a lot of housing in those mill spaces. We're actually going a different route. We want to make sure that every inch of mill space that we can make into industrial commercial again, okay. We want to do. You can live in Lowell. We want you to work in Lawrence. You know, that's what we, you know, you want to live in Haverhill. That's fine. We want you to work in Lawrence. If we don't put people to work, if you had asked me that question, day five, day 10. This has been distilled over time. We've come to a place where we want Lawrence to be a place where people work. Entry-level jobs, high-end jobs, doctors, lawyers in between, everybody in between, because if we don't get people to work, that double-digit unemployment number, it's crazy. Nobody wants to invest. So we got to make sure that people know that we want people to come to Lawrence to work. We have a nice nightlife, too. We have some nice amenities. We have a bunch of ball fields and a bunch of places for people to go and eat. But at the end of the day, we want people to work because we are so in need for jobs.
So what's the, not only what's the formula to create jobs there, but is it transferable to other Lawrences? As you said, this is the typical city of 50, 60, 70,000 people. Is what you're trying to do transferable, or the reverse? Are you borrowing things from other cities that were prosperous, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago that are trying to come back?
Well, I think that we're trying to stay out of the mistakes that others have made, so we watch out for that first and foremost. We do get a lot of coaching. Lisa Wong in Fitchburg is one of my mentors.
Mayor Fitchburg.
And the mayor of Salem's by the fun, because she's Lisa's.
Kim Driscoll.
Kim Driscoll's also a mentor. So I think about the things they're doing and Joe Cordotone in Somerville, the mayor of Somerville, all those things that they're doing, I do kind of try to implement it. But we got to find our own thing. And I think that part of this innovation thing is to see what works for you. I have this idea, and I talked to Secretary Bialecki, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and Economic Development for the state. Mm-hmm. He's really great. And he said to him, you know, if I were to tell you that we're going to charge you $180 a seat to sit on the Green Monster 20 years ago, you're crazy. It's not going to happen. That's what we have with these mill buildings. And what I want to do is do an architectural kind of contest where we say, how do you transfer these buildings into what they look like today into space that really is on the market right now that people are looking for?
A mixed-use kind of thing?
I'm going from 7 stories to 3 stories. Mm-hmm. How do you support it in a way so that you don't have all these support beams every 10 feet, you know, dock? Industrial elevators, all those things. Can you do that in a way that makes financial sense so that when you say, hey, you don't have to go to Foxconn or wherever in China and try to get your manufacturing set up. You can do that in Lawrence. Have the workforce that's, you could pay at a fair rate and if you don't mind a bilingual four. But we got to do those things. You got to transfer the way people come and work in our city. And the second thing of that, just real quick, is that we have to make sure that our workforce can actually be ready to work. And so we're doing ESL for adults to make sure that folks can have the basic language skills to work on a floor. Although, I got to tell you, I've been to 3 or 4 of the floors in Lawrence, and they're all bilingual. The manager speaks English and Spanish, and they speak English to the management, and they speak Spanish to the workers. So we're working on those kind of 2 levels.
Where's the money come from, though? I mean, from what I read about you, and I met you for the first time today, you have a lot of good ideas, a tremendous amount of enthusiasm. You've made a pledge not to raise property taxes, I think, in the next round.
Next round, yeah.
So where does the money, even if you have the best of ideas, where's the dough come from to get do the training, to do the rehabbing, to do all the kinds of things that Mayor Rivera thinks is the rescue ticket for Lawrence?
Well, I got to tell you, the state has been super, super helpful in the last 100 days. The federal government, I think, as well as another mm-hmm. place we can go to. There are programs out there. We just haven't had our act together enough to go after the funding.
Our Lantique was everybody knows the vote was razor thin. 81 votes. Ultimately, he dropped his challenge. You were elected mayor. Are his people trying to have you fail, or have they accepted the democratic outcome and you're able to govern with relatively full support of the people up there?
I have not been stymied in any real way. I think people are asking, intelligent and thoughtful questions of me, and they're going to put, pressures on me, I think, differently than they did on him, and that's okay. I have no problem with that. But at the end of the day, if we don't people know that if I fail, they fail. So I don't see that. But just going back real quick about the piece, how do we make to pay for this stuff, is that you create an environment where people think that and understand that things can happen there. And that's part of it. I forget her name now. I'm black and I always say this. She said to me, do you think you can change a city by smiling and bringing back parades? And yeah. You know, turns out a St. Patrick's Day parade is the only regional parade in, like, not just I thought it was just in my head, as we bring it back for Lawrence, There's not one in Haverhill. There's not one in Lowell. There's not one in Methuen. So you think about a regional event that you can bring a lot of people in your community. So
we only have 30 seconds left.
Sorry about
people,
that.
No apologies. Oh, we want to have you back when we have more time. I assume rents are fairly low.
Yeah,
I assume property is affordable.
Yeah.
If people want to learn more about Lawrence and maybe want to consider moving there or create it.
How much is a nice triple decker in Lawrence?
I'll tell you what, better than that, I got a house, front yard, backyard, deck, 4-bedroom, 1-bath. I paid $198,000 for it.
Wow.
So how do people connect with
you? Just send me an email, Mayor Rivera, cityoflawrence.com.
You read these?
I read, yeah.
And you Mayor get, Rivera at cityoflawrence.com.
And you get a lot of beautiful housing stock up there.
Oh, my God.
Beautiful old houses, parquet wood floors,
stained
glass windows.
People should go to Google Maps and Google Colonial Road, Lawrence, Massachusetts, and you'll see the type of housing we have there.
Okay.
Pleasure to meet you, Mr. Mayor.
Rivera.
Thank you.
Soon,
you guys are great. Appreciate
it. Love to have you in here. He's just marked his 100 days in office. Thank you for listening to Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow for our coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing anniversary, a special 3-hour version. Also, Harvard historian Nancy Kane will be here for open mic. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Our show is a production of WGBH. Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. Thanks.